Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So That Happened is sponsored by Casper, who urged you to forget the mattress showrooms and go online to get an obsessively engineered mattress at an outstanding price. Go to www.casper.com/happened and get started on your risk-free trial of a great mattress today.
This podcast contains explicit language.
I like this picture of baby deer and fluffy bunny caught frolicking in my Facebook feed. I wish I could frolic. Hello, I'm Jason Liggins, host of So That Happened. Okay, you ready?
So That Happened. This week, we learned about the high-value detainee interrogation group, an interagency outfit that was set up to bring the nation's most elite interrogators to bear on high-priority terror suspects. But what we've learned calls into question whether this group really is all that elite. We'll give you the lowdown on this HuffPost investigation. Meanwhile, a group of football players from Northwestern University snapped the ball to the National Labor Relations Board, hoping that the NLRB would run a play that would get America's student-athletes closer to obtaining some real labor rights. Unfortunately, the NLRB chose to punt in the red zone. Former NFL wide receiver Dante Stallworth joins us to discuss what happens next. And that's not all, folks. We've got news you can use about the pet food industry and how hard it is these days to find safe food for Fido. Plus, we take a dip in the 2016 race, ponder Marco Rubio's passing ability, and as much as it pains me to say it, we have news about Donald Trump. I'm Jason Liggins with Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, Paige Lavender, Travis Waldron, and Allie Watkins. And here's what happened first. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to So That Happened. It's a podcast about junk and stuff. I'm Jason Liggins, editor of Eat the Press at the Huffington Post. And joining me always are my friends. One friend is Mr.
Zach Carter, senior political economy for the Huffington Post.
And also joining us today is
Allie Watkins, intelligence reporter for the Huffington Post.
That's right.
I feel like that job title is a little bit unfair.
I know. I don't really like it. It freaks me out because there can be intelligence reporters who are not necessarily intelligent.
But it suggests that you are. And I kind of like, what do I get out of senior political economy? It just makes me sound like,
I'm barely above staff writer at this place. So,
but we missed you, dude. You've been gone for 2 weeks.
I have. And I know that great lengths were taken during the 2 weeks I was gone to make it appear that I was still here. Like it was like actually kind of absurd.
You don't need to worry about the debate, dude. We got it covered.
Of course we don't. I'm of the opinion. Right now, we're at the nonsense time in American politics as far as the presidential election goes. 2016, we're in August 2015. And it's a period of time, I think, all of us, we're political reporters. We tend to we're into this stuff every day. We read this stuff every day. We tweet about it. We write about it. We're constantly hyper aware of what's going on in 2016. And I think that we tend to think, well, not all of us, but I think a lot of us tend to think that the American people must be as invested in politics as much as we are. But in August 2015, I don't think the American people give a shit. And I think that when I went across the fucking ocean and stopped reading the news and only started caring about tapas and wine.
And ancient things.
I saw
the photos.
And ancient things. I think I actually obtained the state of awareness that most normal Americans have about presidential politics right now, which is that they're sort of aware that there's a race happening and that there's a debate. Oh, Donald Trump's a candidate. That's neat. We'll see what happens in January.
So you felt like a real person.
I felt like, it's funny. I had to go to Spain to start to feel like a real person again. How about that?
That's wow. Very poetic.
If you were running for office, people would say that you had just apologized for America and you would be fucked.
That's why I don't run for office. because politicians really do run away from anything that makes them fucked, quote unquote. Whereas I sprint in that direction.
I think I did that in college a lot.
I'm the sort of person who's like, if I do this, will like more people think I'm an asshole? Okay, sign me up. I'll do it.
Yeah.
That's kind of Donald Trump's like strategy, I think.
As little as I think the American public is paying attention to the presidential race, they have been paying much less attention to this kind of weird, it's not an agency, it's like an amalgam of different intelligence groups that Ali just reported on.
So tell us about the terrible shit that's happening with this, what was supposed to be a special interrogation team.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the biggest questions here is that, you know, we don't necessarily know if terrible shit's happening. A lot of this story is just we don't know what's happening with this group. So it's, long story short, it's this special interrogation group. Obama stands it up in 2009 as the smoldering ruins of the CIA torture program and the U.S. reputation is burning around him, and says, hey, we're going to do this thing where we no longer let the CIA just do whatever the hell it wants. We're going to do an interagency group that's led by the FBI that is basically the best interrogators from all these different intelligence agencies. You get rotated into this high-value detainee interrogation group called the HIG. And whenever we capture somebody, we're going to be like, okay, go team. And we get like a group of like really qualified people together and send them out, interrogate people for intelligence, and it's going to be great. And
so they're supposed to be like the Avengers, only the interrogators.
Essentially, yeah. There's probably like some superhero uniforms. Right. I'm sure capes are involved. But the whole premise of this was kind of, you know, it was twofold. You know, part of it was we need a group that's dedicated to actually following the law and being humans. And also,
no more rectal feeding.
Yeah, like let's kind of try to get away from that. And then also this concept of a clean break. So you need like a clean team to interrogate people. So it's just for intelligence gathering purposes. You don't have people like doing these kinds of weird interrogations and then feeding information to prosecutors. It's basically the HIG was intended to come in and strictly interrogate for intelligence purposes. Okay. You know, the Miranda warning isn't a part of this. It's not a part of the prosecution. So they come in and gather intelligence and then, you know, lock off any communication between lawyers or whoever's handling this. They go do their intelligence thing and then the judicial process happens.
Okay.
So it's intended to be this kind of like fresh page every time we catch someone, send these experts in, we get great stuff out of it, you know, voila.
And they've done work that we've heard of before. I mean,
yeah.
They were the team that interrogated some of the high value targets that we've read about in newspapers.
Yeah, the Times Square bomber, right. The Boston bomber. They were just dispatched to interrogate the ISIS wife, Sayef, who was the wife of the ISIS target who was killed in a drone strike. So they have been dispatched and they have been sent out to interrogate people. But there's a lot of concerns that have arisen in the last 6 years since this thing was started.
And you know that they can't have their shit together because the acronym is HIG, HIG, and yet it's the High Value Detainee Interrogation Group.
Yeah,
clearly it's HIDVIGO. Yeah,
for a town that is so like that prides itself on acronyms, they really fucked this one up.
That's just
yeah
an embarrassment. So anyway, how else have they? What are the real problems?
So I mean, there's a lot of questions around the HIG. I mean, a couple of the instances that we put forth in the story is, you know, in the 6 years since it was started, there's a lot of sources who say that the best interrogators aren't actually rotated into this thing. That, you know, for example, if the Defense Intelligence Agency has like three top of the line interrogators, why would they send them to the HIG? We're just going to keep them with DIA and DIA will get a chance to interrogate these
targets. So who is part of the HIG?
So a part of the HIG. Yeah. So the HIG does involve the CIA. It's FBI led and CIA and the Pentagon, which is usually the Defense Intelligence Agency, all like feed people into the HIG. It's led by an FBI director, and then there's two deputy directors, a CIA guy and a Pentagon, usually DIA guy, and then interrogators, linguists, analysts, they're all kind of rotated in from government agencies to serve on the HIG for either part-time or full-time terms.
And one guy who just shoots arrows at things for some reason.
Just for the hell of it. He's like in the back just like throwing a dartboard at like an old picture of Osama bin Laden just to see He's like in a separate office.
Right.
Yeah.
So one concern is that people at the CIA say, well, you know, we want to keep our good interrogators at the CIA, but we'll give you, you know, the B teamers. They can go off and be.
Yeah, essentially. And then, I mean, it doesn't just complicate the agency process. It complicates the oversight process, too, because, you know, the intelligence committees say, no, we have primary jurisdiction over this thing because we handle the budget. And yet the Judiciary and Armed Services committees are like, no, we had to look at this thing sometimes, too, because, like, we're involved. It's the definition of a Washington pissing contest, making, like, these operations difficult.
Okay, well, let's look at it this way. So not everyone could play on the Golden State Warriors, right? So let's say the CIA has their Golden State Warriors interrogation team. Like, the HIG can still be, you know, the Indiana Pacers, right? Pretty good. It can still be pretty good. So where is there a deficiency beyond just simply we're not getting the best? Are they getting just, like, complete dregs?
Well, that's part of the question here, is that as far as the HIG is set up, the only formal interrogation training that you have to go through once you are assigned to the HIG is a week-long course.
Well, I could do a week-long course.
You could do this course.
Well, wait, but you pointed out in your article, Ali, that there seems to be, I mean, it's the thing that I'm most interested in when we talk about replacing the CIA torture program is making sure the United States isn't torturing people anymore, because that seemed to be a problem.
Yes.
But then in your article, you say that there are two different sort of legal standards by which, or legal guides by which the interrogators can abide. And one of them is a lot more flexible than another.
Yeah. And that I think is one of the bigger parts of the story that we wrote today, is that you have all these resources being put into this training manual, you know, that focuses on non-coercive techniques, rapport building. I mean, it makes a lot of sense when you kind of talk to people about it, that it's all about cultural building and rapport building and getting to know someone to get them to talk to you, which is, you know, any professional interrogator will tell you is the right way to do it. So you have the HIG teaching this week-long training course that you should interrogate this way. But then the reality is nobody is bound to that manual, and they can follow the Army Field Manual or any other approved interrogation tactic. And the problem that you run into, you know, as far as the Army Field Manual, there's been a lot of professional interrogators who have sounded the alarm over that. You know, it allows for sleep deprivation. It allows for solitary confinement. I mean, when you read through it, it's very carefully parsed that you can scare people. You can humiliate people, but you have to very carefully toe a line. It's basically saying you can scare someone, but, like, don't freak them out too much. And you can make someone embarrassed, but don't humiliate them.
Jason, look at this photo. Yeah. Look at this photo.
We don't want to piss off the UN.
We're not going to show it to your mom, but you look at it.
It's pretty
bad. You know what's in here.
Yeah. So the question is that you have this kind of...
I did 9/11. That worked.
This warring ideology of, like, you have these non-coercive rapport-building techniques that you're asking these people to follow, but the reality is they have so much more latitude than that. And one of the problems that we found with talking to sources is that you have this training that happens, but a lot of the people who are assigned to the HIG in typical intelligence community American cowboy fashion don't necessarily think they need to be told how to interrogate. And a lot of people who we talk to who have had experience with these rapport-building techniques, who have been involved in HIG training and involved with the group, said that one of their biggest struggles has been even finding out if the interrogators are using these non-rapport-building techniques. You know, are they just sitting through this week-long course and then saying, screw you, we're going to keep someone awake for 20 hours?
Right. There's a guy in your piece who you mentioned, like, just sort of, I had a gut feeling about
it. Yeah.
It turns out he had never interrogated anyone.
He was an infantryman before he joined DIA. And so he went through this course, and one of the trainers asked him, you know, how do you know that guy's lying? I mean, it's a very, when you talk to people about this course, it's a very clear structure of, like, this is what you ask someone to find out with their lying. You know, you don't tell if someone looks to the left and breathes weird. You know, that's like so 24 Jack Bauer. And so, you know, these trainers were asking this guy, how do you know he's lying? And he says, well, I just knew it in my gut. And the trainers were like, this is the problem. Like, this is, you know, there's a way to explain it.
But at least people aren't being chained to the ceiling wearing a diaper, forced to, like, piss on themselves.
We want to be very clear. Like, and that was a struggle with the story, is that we don't want to suggest they're ripping people's fingernails off. Like, there's been no one who has suggested
that's
happening.
If this agency isn't effective, doesn't that give some sort of political backstop to people who want to bring back torture?
Exactly. And you have this question of, was it even worth it? You know, if we still have not been able to master a way to make these non-coercive rapport-building techniques relevant, and to even make the intelligence community see them as relevant, then what kind of staying power do these reforms have?
And there are Republicans on the oversight committees, right, who are openly in favor of...
of torture, who see no value in the Hague, who see no value in rapport-building techniques or anything like that.
One last question, because we've got to wrap up, but I wanted to ask. In previous Allie Watkins reporting, the Federal Bureau of Investigation has been a shining star compared to some other intelligence agencies. How were they when it came to reporting this story?
Amazingly, after I started making calls for this story, I was told, well, we can't help you out right now because the Hague has decided that in the next few weeks, we're going to put out a public document and be super transparent because we decided this is a good idea. And I have a couple questions with that. But the biggest one is, why are we now just deciding being semi-transparent about interrogation is a good idea? Like, there was a kind of a problem with this about 6 years ago. I don't know why this is a new advent that, like, hey, we should. And I mean, the stupid part is that it was benign questions like, hey, who appoints your director? What is the criteria to get put into the Hague? Where does your budget come from? And they were just like, I don't know, it's probably classified.
The Hague, it's somewhere doing something probably well, but maybe not. All right, thank you. Allie Watkins, you can follow her on Twitter at AliWatkins. Hey everybody, are you in the market for a new mattress? Well, you could spend all day at a mattress store testing good mattresses and testing bad mattresses, and probably paying a fair amount for that privilege. Or you can go to Casper.com right now and buy one obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. Casper mattresses have just the right sink and just the right bounce because they bring two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, together for better days and brighter nights. And the best thing is that you can try a Casper for 100 days right now for free delivery, and if you're not excited about it, painless returns. These mattresses were made in America, and they're $500 for a twin, $950 for a king-size mattress. Go right now to casper.com/happened and get started on your risk-free trial on a great mattress today. Hey, we're back, and we're back with Zach Carter.
Hello.
May or may not have just been here.
I'm always with you. I'm always with you, Jason.
I like how I just like completely just bollocks that. And joining us also is our good friend and former NFL wide receiver and Tom Brady's personal friend.
Friend to animals. Stallworth.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
Glad
Appreciate
to have it. You here.
Glad to be on.
So we got you here for a number of reasons, but the first thing we want to talk about is and the 2016 race this week.
This is really, the most important news.
Really important event happened. And it is, probably a lot of you out there listening have at least seen the GIF or the video. But Marco Rubio threw a pass to a young kid, and
yeah, I saw it.
Kid hit kid in the face or the head,
wiped him out. I mean, it was a disaster as plays go.
Yeah,
hit in the face and fall down.
I mean,
that ever happened to you on the field, Dante? Get hit in the face and fall down?
I can't confirm or deny that.
I'm putting in some calls to the Cleveland Browns.
it did kind of remind me of the very famous like Sanchez to Tebow play.
Oh my! Oh.
That happened what, two seasons ago. But I wanted to like just sort of break down Rubio's technique, you know, as a quarterback. I mean, what did you think about what was he doing right or wrong? How were his mechanics?
His mechanics were not very good.
Okay.
And as you tweeted, you know, he had an open pocket. He had a free pocket.
That's right.
Pocket.
Yeah.
So
not a whole lot of pressure in that play.
Not really. And then, you know, he's got a wide open guy too. And you typically for quarterbacks and wide receivers, those throws and catches are usually the hardest when a guy's wide open, because it's like, I want to hit him in stride. I don't want to mess this up. He's wide open. And then for the receiver, it's like, oh my God, I'm wide open, but the ball is taking 20 light years to get here. And there's no one here, so it's only me and the ball. Don't drop it. And I think that's what happened to both of them. But Rubio threw a, I want to say it was a catchable ball, but I mean, it came out kind of like a kickoff.
It was a little wobbly.
It was a lot of wobbly. It was a lot of wobbly.
Here's the thing I've never said. I know that you're supposed to throw a nice tight spiral. Why? Why does that matter?
It makes it a lot easier because it's when the ball's coming at you nice and tight, it's a tight spiral, and you're able to catch it a lot easier. That's what coaches, quarterback coaches, tell their quarterbacks to make, throw a catchable ball.
Mm-hmm.
But as a wide receiver, you are trained in your mind to catch the ball regardless. Peyton Manning has been doing this since college, and he does not throw spirals at all.
Hmm.
I mean, if you look at a lot of Peyton Manning's highlights, they are quack quacks coming at you.
Yeah, goofy.
But
real goofy.
Yeah,
balls.
But I mean, you know, they get there on time, they hit you in stride.
They're catchable.
And he's extremely accurate, and they're catchable.
Yeah,
because they come at you, you know, nice. It's like they come at you like a loaf of bread. Rubio, he tried to lead him. He didn't lead him. It was a very hard catch because it was over the kid's head. And then the kid fell down, and I hope not his foreign policy to, you know, to hurt our allies.
Leading
like that.
From
Come
behind.
On, Marco Rubio. and the thing is, he really did kind of underthrow the kid, too, and he threw it behind him.
Yeah.
So the kid had to reach up, like, which is a very difficult catch. I mean, it's, you know, because those are the ones you don't, when it's coming at you, you have to gauge it in the air, and you have to either, if you're going to turn up, open with an open chest, or you're going to catch it over your shoulder. And those are difficult. Those are extremely difficult. So I really can't blame the kid as much as I'd blame Marco. If Marco would have threw it in front of him and maybe led him inside a little bit, but then you have the safety there. But
right.
Then again, he was wide open.
I just have one last question I got to ask. Okay, when you're the receiver in that situation, you go out for a pass, the quarterback kind of puts it in a bad place.
Right.
What do you say to the guy when you get back to the huddle? Are you like, oh, come on now, man?
Well, if it's Brady, you don't say anything. You just get back in the huddle and you just go to and you just go to the next play.
All right. Good enough.
If it's a younger guy, then you just kind of look at him like, you know, hey, let's go. I never messed with my quarterback, so I understand the, you know, the pressures that they have. So I was never that guy, but there are other receivers who don't care, and if they're open, they expect the ball. I was never like that.
Yeah. All right, man. It sounds to me like Marco and the kid need to just, like, work out some of the kinks.
They need to work out some of the kinks. You know, he needs to lift some of the sanctions off the kid and, you know. I mean, you know, it's just like you can't do that to your allies, man. You can't do that to your allies.
All right. Awesome. All right. Dante, thanks for breaking that down for us. And we're back once again. We continue on with Dante Stallworth.
Yeah, I'm here.
And joining us now, making his So That Happened debut, is our good friend, Travis Waldron.
Finally on.
Travis.
What's up, brother?
I'm good. How are you, man?
Good. Good to see you.
You too.
Travis comes to us. You've been here. How long have you been here now? Like a couple
almost,
months.
Almost
right?
3 months.
3 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. Travis is.
Time flies.
If you're following Travis on our page, he covers the intersection of politics and sports, and we're going to get into that a little bit today. Also, Travis, big Arsenal fan. So that.
Unfortunately
for all of us. Winger out. But okay, so we're talking this week about the latest in what's been going on with the college football union drive, something that took on a lot of currency last year. I think more and more people are becoming aware of the fact that there's major discrepancies in the sort of way the life of a student athlete is kind of popularly depicted and the way it is. There's, I think a lot of people were a bit shocked when the Connecticut basketball players talked about going to bed hungry.
This is true. I've been there.
Yeah.
I've been there.
Colton Kane.
Kane
kid,
Coulter.
Sorry. Two different dudes. two different dudes. Kane Coulter. Sorry. My apologies to Colton Kane. Kane Coulter, who was kind of being the face of Northwestern and the college players' attempt to unionize, has been through a lot. There was a Deadspin article this week that described how much he's been through. He started taking shit from people just when he started pointing out how hard they worked and how many hours they worked. Mm-hmm. But the big news, I'm sure, let's Travis break down big news this week from the National Labor Relations Board.
Right. So they ruled, they basically punted, to steal a football metaphor.
That's good.
They said they were going to decline to use their jurisdiction to allow players to unionize, which is a pretty big defeat for the players. It's, you know, long story short, is probably the end of the road for that particular avenue for changing the landscape of college sports and how student athletes are treated. And, you know, it was kind of shocking, I thought, that the NLRB decided, you know, we could rule on this and we're just not going to. there are people who have said it's kind of a cop-out, and that's certainly one way to read it. And you know, I think it would have been a big-time political decision for them to rule either way. They would have caught flack from one side or the other.
So they just defaulted.
So they just said, you know, here's default to the status quo. Right. Exactly. And, right. you know, it's unfortunate because it would have been some sort of resolution to this, maybe not a resolution, but it would have been some step forward for student athletes to have these rights.
And, well, sorry, Chad. Well, that's the thing is like, They ruled and said, but this decision, quote, does not preclude reconsideration of this issue in the future. It pretty much does because now you've right. set precedent.
I was going
to ask. Right. Like, yeah. I mean, yeah. Really? It's basically really? Saying you're going to have one hell of a case
yeah.
to come back to us. Really? Yeah. That's a good point. You know, a lot of people pointed to that as, well, yeah, the door's still open. Not really. right. You know, the labor experts that Dave Jamieson and I talked to were basically like, no, this is it.
Wow. Wow.
The, you know, that they would have to have such a marked change in the case to take it back to the NLRB and get a ruling.
What
and
was that compelling about the case they brought to the National Labor Relations Board? I actually have an easier time saying it out loud than I do saying the acronym. So NLRB, okay. What was it? What was not compelling about their case?
Well, they didn't really say there was anything not compelling about it.
But
that's the striking thing is they didn't really take a stance on the question, the central question, which is are college athletes employees of their universities? The right. regional director in Chicago last year ruled that they were, that Northwestern right. student, Northwestern athletes qualified as employees. I think, in my view, if you look at what college athletes are, and I don't think you have to be necessarily an expert on this, if you've gone to college, if you've gone to a major university, and you've looked at what athletes do, they look an awful lot like employees.
Kind of.
They get, right. you know, there's a contractual agreement
yeah.
between them and their school, which is their scholarship.
Right.
They're controlled by their program. They have to live up to certain standards or else they can lose that scholarship. That looks a lot like work.
Take us inside what it's like to just be a student athlete and in a major sport, like a big money-making sport.
We'll have these 6 o'clock a.m. workouts, 6 a.m. workouts during the spring, during the summer. And so our day pretty much starts at like 6 a.m. on those days, which are a lot of days throughout the season. Or, I'm sorry, in the off season.
Right.
We're still taking at least 12 to 16, 18 hours each semester. And they give us these. Now, it's I was when the dinosaurs were roaming the earth. That's when I was back in college. And I'm sure not much has changed since. Obviously, the kid from UConn, after they won the national championship, he talked about how he goes to bed hungry. Well, I know when I was in school, There were certain meals we didn't even have, but yet you are demanding us to be up at 6 a.m. and then still take 12 to 15 or 12 to 18 hours of classwork. That is essentially a job. So at the very least, feed the kids.
Right,
I mean,
right.
make sure that you give them. And I'm not talking about, you know, the prime steaks and all that, but I mean, if you're going to ask them to go out and perform in their respective sport, then you have to give them the proper nourishment that they need. To me, that's the NCAA. Like, how is that even an issue?
The food is an interesting point here. Food is kind of how this whole thing started. Ramogi Huma, right. who is the guy behind the National Collegiate Players Association, which then became the College Athletes Players Association. That was the union that would have been there for the Northwestern players. He started his activism on this issue because one of his teammates at UCLA got in trouble for getting a bag of groceries
right.
from someone. That right. was an it's impermissible crazy. Benefit.
Right.
You go to the point at UConn, Shabazz Napier said he goes to bed hungry. That caused the NCAA to change
right.
their food exactly. policy. They relaxed their meal standards.
But it's sad that, Travis, it's very sad that it took that. You know what
so,
I'm saying?
Right, and so you're talking it's about crazy. Being inside of it, and I saw it from a different view when mm-hmm. I was at the University of Kentucky and I was right. working for the student paper. We won't talk about that. This is the year. Probably not. But when I was there, I was doing a story on an offensive lineman, and he invited me over to his apartment to do the interview, and he lived with one of the defensive linemen, mm-hmm. And he got up in the middle of the interview to cook dinner, and they had like 10 chicken breasts, and I was like, oh, are y'all having people over? He's like, nah.
Right.
This is for us.
Right, right.
Like, the amount of food it takes to feed a college football player, a college athlete, when they're burning. You know, there was a story last week of J.J. Watt, 9,000 calories a day.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, these guys are on, they're working out, they're going to practice, they're going to class, just to keep them moving for a day.
Olympic swimmers,
right.
Man.
Right.
Put that, like, stuff down.
It doesn't, right. It's not, right. Like, you don't just do it on a normal, you know, person diet.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's what was shocking to me, because that's all biology. I figured that to run a world-class athletic program, those are just the basic elements of
right.
What you do to make it succeed.
Exactly.
It's like calories in, calories out. You know, so to hear a kid, especially in a world-class program like Connecticut.
A world-class program on a national stage, you know what I mean?
Yes.
After a championship game.
Yeah, say
know?
That.
So yeah, it's but you know, it's, we need kids like that to speak up more, because you'll get what's going on the inside, and because the NCAA, they just pretty much do what they want until situations like this happen where it comes to light and everyone's like, whoa, and then it's like, oh, we have to do something now. We have to do something.
One of the things that's always kind of ground my gears about the way college athletes get traded is, of course, the revenue generated by players.
Yep.
You know, when I was at UVA, if you walked in the student bookstore to buy a football jersey, it had Thomas Jones' number on
right.
it. And it had Thomas
right.
Jones' number on it for a reason.
Right.
He was our star player.
It wasn't just accidentally.
Yeah,
number
it wasn't
three
like,
or,
oh, I felt right. six right. seems yeah. like a good right. number.
Right.
It sounds great. So, but he didn't right. see a dime of that revenue.
Nope.
Meanwhile, you got kids, and I think this actually took place in Northwestern too. You get a kid like they had a one-time quarterback who was in their theater program, and he was denied the right to take a theater job.
At UVA?
No, this is at Northwestern.
Okay. Oh, you can't. Yeah.
Right.
Who?
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I thought you knew his name. I can't.
Oh, no.
I came here without his name. But okay, but in theory, you could. There are a lot of kids. I was in the theater program at UVA too, and there are a lot of athletes in the program because they understood that, like, getting better at being voice, diction, composure made them more interviewable and
right.
it would be better for their career. So we trained a lot of people in acting.
Mm-hmm.
But if they had, you know, auditioned for a professional theater job, like a lot, like all of us in the program were doing.
Right.
They would not have been allowed to take it.
You're because, an amateur.
Right, because they were, well, I mean, yes, because they're permanently amateur in all things.
Right.
They couldn't trade on their name to
exactly.
do anything.
Right.
If they were a great oboe player, they couldn't
we
sign with an or orchestra.
Well, and it's like,
and
that
it's
there
crazy,
was a kid,
man.
Too,
because
who
no
came
one else
up with,
college.
He was, there was a kid, too, a couple years ago who was in a design, he was in like a interior, not a like a clothing design program at his school,
right?
And he won a contest, and he couldn't sell the shirts and stuff that he designed.
Yeah,
you know, it's remarkable that all of this money is being generated. These kids have talent. You say it's about the education,
yeah,
but a kid who is good at his job
or good at another
or
job.
Good at another job,
yeah.
Can't trade in that. I think it's nuts. But I do think the amount of money that's coming
just
in
just like
now,
anti-capitalist.
Right. But the amount of money that's coming in to college sports now with the major NCAA tournament TV money, the $1 billion yeah. that was generated in 1 year off the college football playoff.
Crazy.
I think it is, we're reaching the point where there will be more Kane Coulters.
Yeah.
There will be more Shabazz Napiers. There will be, you know, we have right now on the University of Wisconsin basketball team that went to the national championship game.
Yeah.
One of their players is part of the major antitrust lawsuit that could totally upend the way college sports work right now. There are going to be more and more of these guys. And I think the important point about Northwestern is it was only one front.
Yeah,
it was only one place where guys were attacking right. the NCAA. There are multiple others. There are antitrust suits. There's going to continue to be efforts to change the way this happens. The NCAA can sit here and issue statements like it did, saying we are trying to make it better.
Yeah,
but
they're
only making it better because they're being forced.
Exactly.
And they're going to continue. Like, these college athletes aren't dumb jocks.
No, I know.
They are not. You know, they're not idiots. They can see all of this money
right.
coming in.
Right.
And yeah. eventually they're going to make the calculation that this is not a bargain.
If someone at the National Labor Relations Board wants to come on my podcast and tell me why they're not cowards, by all means,
I think,
call,
I think ever, I think the courts, I think everyone is looking around and no one wants to be first.
Right.
I think there's a big game of you first going on
right.
that everyone's looking at each other and saying, look, we realize that this isn't right. We realize something needs to change. We don't want to be the ones to pull the plug.
Right,
we don't want to be the ones to turn the table over.
Right.
All right. Well, that's maybe the fairest way of putting it.
Travis is a fair guy. Travis is a fair guy.
All right, Travis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Will be right back.
All right, we're back. It's me, Arthur Delaney, with Zach Carter and Paige Lavender.
Hey.
My
friends on the HuffPost politics team. And we're going to talk about pets.
Woohoo!
Especially dogs, but also cats. And a great feature story that Zach published about the pet food industry, its many suspect claims of nutritional value, and its lax regulation by the government.
It's a great story and a terrifying story for pet owners.
So basically, I believe the story says your dog might die.
Well, one of the things that's really sad about being a pet owner is that you actually do know that your dog will die.
Wait a minute. Isn't that one of the sad things about being a person, too?
It is. And it sucks just in general. There are problems like this in the universe. But pet, I mean, with the caveat that most pet food is safe, there have
been. And that's a big caveat.
Right. There have been some really catastrophic pet food safety failures over the past decade or so. And the biggest one, the most famous one, is in 2007 when thousands of pets are believed to have died because of essentially poison that was put in it for profit, basically. By ultimately, it turned out to be a couple of Chinese suppliers.
The poison was a way to they cut corner. They weren't like we're going to kill pets and then profit.
Right, right. It was a chemical called melamine, which was designed to mimic the reaction that they that ingredient testers that pet food testers have when they actually test their food to have the same reaction that you would get for protein.
Oh.
And so protein is one of the most expensive ingredients in pet food. So if you can have this cheap chemical in there instead, then you as the supplier can be like, all right, you paid me for all this expensive protein, but here I sent you some melamine. And it turns out that melamine can kill pets, and the Chinese suppliers just weren't up on their animal science on that.
And so how has regulation changed in the wake of the big pet food disaster of 2007?
So that's the thing that's troubling for the industry right now is not much. In 2010, Congress passed a law that said, you know, we're going to stop doing this whole recall game where we wait for all the pet food to be poisoned and have it pulled from the shelves like they did in 2007 and start having a more proactive federal standard of regulation where you have to do certain things to keep your food from ending up being contaminated. And it's, I think, in general, pet food safety advocates are pretty happy with the rule that they expect the FDA to write under that law. The problem is that law was passed in 2010. The deadline for that rule to pass was 2012. It still hasn't been implemented.
Now, typically, that means they're having a comment period where pet food industry people are like, do this, do that.
Right, and the pet food industry has lobbied against this really, really hard. And one of my favorite sort of facts from the story is that in one of the comment letters that that the Pet Food Institute, which is sort of the main lobbying body for all the biggest pet food companies,
an institute,
yeah, but it's basically like big kibble, you know. they said in their comment letter, look, we don't need to do this very expensive and rigorous testing regime that the FDA has proposed, because in 2007, 15%+ of our pet food samples were contaminated with salmonella, and now it's only 2.5%.
Yeah,
and one of the fun things about numbers is that in American politics, if you don't get to 51%, like that's a low number. But in business, when the pet food industry is like a $22 billion industry, you know, a 2.5% market share, you know, if you just played out, you know, straight across all types of and prices of food, that's like $500 million of salmonella tainted food potentially. So that's a pretty significant portion of the market that is potentially unsafe. And that's the argument that Big Kibble is making against further regulation.
Because they use a small number.
Right.
So, Paige Lavender, you recently adopted a dog. How did you decide what to feed the dog And what'd you wind up going with?
That's a good question. So our dog was actually with a foster before she came to live with my boyfriend and me. And so we basically just fed her what the foster said. But it did start out, we went to PetSmart with this girl who'd been taking care of our dog, whose name is Pickle, and we'll be referred to as that from here on out. So we went to PetSmart with this girl, and she's like, we've been buying her this expensive food, but it's so expensive. Like, you should probably wean her off this food onto, like, a cheaper brand. And I didn't actually ask her why she went with the expensive food at first, but I imagine it's because, like it says in your story, like, you feel a little better when, like, it's like the same when you're buying human food, like when it says, like, because these ingredients are, like, all natural or whatever.
And in general, expensive means better, right?
Right. Well, that's what you think.
That's the entire premise of Donald Trump's existence.
Yeah. So we ended up going with I'm's Smart Puppy, which is in, like, a big orange bag, and I chatted Zach whenever the story first, went to edit, and I thought, oh my God, am I killing my dog? Like, I'm so scared to give her anything.
Well, wait, did you get the kind with arsenic or without? Now, how does it different between the mainstream big bag of food like IAMS and this expensive stuff that has proliferated in the last, like, couple decades?
Well, so I mean, it depends on the bag of IAMS you get, but there are some types of IAMS that are considered pretty pricey. They're just more mainstream.
Is there a food safety difference between the regular cheaper stuff and this fancier stuff with its health claims?
So that's the thing, is that both health claims and the pet safety claims, they tend to be pretty standard. And the problems with supply chain oversight, it's mostly about not what people say is in the food, but actually how they manage their supply chain. So a lot of these companies, they're primarily marketing companies who are charging you more money for pet food because it makes you feel good to say, oh, I got him the premium stuff that doesn't have, nasty chicken byproducts in it. There's just not a whole lot of evidence that chicken byproducts are any – there actually is no evidence that byproducts are any better or worse for your dogs than just something that says chicken. But they sound gross. It's like chicken feet and chicken intestines. It's stuff that you and I don't want to eat. But these companies, they don't – a lot of them don't make it in their own factories. It gets made in, a supplier's factory who gets parts from suppliers all over the world, who themselves gets stuff from a second and third party. I kind of – when I talk to people about it now, I think about – so Pepper is my dog, right? And she gets – sometimes when she's been, like, really good, I'll go to, like, the cheap 50% aisle of the Safeway and get the meat that's about to expire, like, whatever, beef for stew or something. It's the cheapest stuff there. It's going bad in a day. And, I'll cook some of that up for her and add it to her food, like, over the course of the week. And she, like, gets really excited about dinner time. That costs, like, $3.50 a pound when that happens. Even the fancy pants stuff, like Blue Buffalo is one of the fancy pants brands we name in the story. That's still about $1.50 a pound. So it's a lot less than getting meat that's about to expire. The point is that the ingredients that go into pet food are really cheap, and people should get pet foods that seem to work for their dogs. If you like what your dog seems to be behaving, and your vet says the food is good for them, then that's probably good. And if you don't like it, then you should think about changing it. But you're not just because the marketing on the bag says all natural and organic or made with fresh fruits and veggies doesn't necessarily mean anything for your dog's health.
I've been buying my dog George Dog Einstein brand food, and he hasn't come up with anything.
He seems dog
to be a dumb animal.
That's
not a real brand. I made that up.
Oh. I was like, do I need to look at
baby Einstein?
No, he eats IAMS. He eats the brown chunks.
Brown
it's
chunks?
Disgusting.
It's dog food. It's dog food. And if you want to feed your dog food that's not, cheap sort of leftover crap from other types of supplies, then don't feed them dog food, otherwise feed them dog food.
I have a baby who crawls around. He'll put a seashell or a worm in his mouth, and he goes to the dog bowl, and he won't even put that in his mouth.
Aww.
Anyway.
Maybe because he knows it belongs to the dog and he's not trying to steal from other people. He's just not thieving at a young age.
If he knew that, he wouldn't have gone that far.
Well, who's he stealing the worms from?
Yeah, that's true.
All right. Thank you so much, Zach.
Thanks, guys.
And Paige.
Thanks.
Hey, we're back once again. Dante Stallworth remains with us.
Hey.
Throughout, and now we're joined by our good friend, Arthur Delaney.
Arthur.
Thank you for including me.
God, look at that smile. Look at that smile. If you could only see Arthur's bright, shiny smile right now, you'd want to follow him on Twitter.
At Arthur Delaney HP, please follow me or I'll be sad.
Right.
Please follow him. He's a good follow.
Yes, we have like a lot of, we're willing to endorse people following you. Okay, so we want to talk about 2016 again. Arthur, what do you want to talk about?
Well, if it's, the topic is 2016, the topic is Trump.
Really?
And I just want to say why I think he's ahead at this point.
Okay, why don't
and
you?
And also, after that, I want to explain why it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Because our politics has been dominated by people who are megalomaniacs. And along comes the most uninhibited megalomaniacal guy ever. And so just it's inevitable that this would happen and he would be winning during this weakest part of the primary process. And it will be fleeting, though.
I'm intrigued by this. This week, former Obama speechwriter John Lovett wrote a piece for, I want to say the Daily Beast, but I'm probably wrong, that sort of like imagined a post-Trump presidency. And one of the themes that emerges in this thing is that in his like fictional account of what happens at the end of Trump's presidency is that we all as a country come to realize that our leaders had been kind of trending in the megalomaniacal egomaniac direction and it was what we deserved and we issued a course correction.
It's so true. Like Ted Cruz.
Guy Fieri. I just gave away the ending. President Guy Fieri.
Guy Fieri is actually a logical next step.
Totally. Totally. So that's good. So you think that everyone needs like a Susan of egomania to run for president, but
I don't think they need it. But that's who we've been getting and who we've been promoting over the past many years.
Well, it's funny you say that, Jace, because a friend of mine who writes for the NFL, Albert Breer, this was I don't know a month ago when one of the early polls came out and Trump was leading by a wide margin, and he said. Because he was obviously covering a lot of the Brady stuff, so he was extremely busy and couldn't really keep up with what, you know, and stuff. So he said, he tweeted me back and he said, that's exactly who we deserve. If this is where this is going, this is probably who we deserve. I mean, you know, but a post-Trump presidency, I would like to believe that, are we even going to be here?
Do you not just automatically envision a smoldering wasteland?
Are we even going to be here?
Nuclear fallout? Like,
no, if Trump gets elected, I know I put myself on the market. I'm like, come on, come at me, country.
You're speaking of football. There's
bid on me. Who wants me?
The president has a football, and that's the word they use for the briefcase with nuclear codes in it, right?
Yeah.
No doubt he would like, let's fire that up.
Yeah.
There's a
somebody's bothering me.
There's good.
You're a loser.
So, but can we get back to one of my theories about Trump? And this is one of the reasons that because I hold this belief so deeply, it's one of the reasons that even as the world kind of insists that we engage with Trump as a credible candidate, I just can't. And it's that my belief is that for Donald Trump, winning the presidency is actually the worst case scenario. Like the guy has gotten rich and successful and famous by pursuing his career is based on sort of like the pursuit of maximum return on minimum responsibility.
Yes.
So there's no amount of responsibility that I think matches what it means to be president of the United States.
He doesn't want it. He knows he's not going to get it. And here's why everyone else should get a clue right now.
Yeah.
And people are pooping on the Huffington Post because, oh, you cover it as entertainment.
I love that, by the way.
Why do you deny your readers this important news?
We're not denying
Trump is the front runner. What's he got? 25%. You're going to win with 25%?
No, you're not.
No,
you're not.
It's not enough points.
I think
you need more.
I think a lot of people sort of imagine that that 25%. Now, the argument that you'd say is that, well, everyone else has only got 12%. How do they win?
Add them all up, and it's more.
Exactly. How they win, I think a lot of people don't understand that there's not going to be 17 candidates in January.
Right. Yeah. Take all their little 1% point whatever and add it up, and it's more than what Donald Trump has.
Right. And
this is just math.
Rick Perry's
easy math.
There's going to be a sizable portion of Rick Perry supporters, whoever they are, that are not going to go to Trump and go on up the line.
Who would Donald Trump's running mate be? Can we just hypothetically answer that?
He was asked. I know by he said CNN Oprah. Or somebody.
I know he mentioned Oprah, but I was thinking more. He mentioned Oprah. He said Oprah would make a great vice president.
No. Now that he's deeper
in the
weeds. No. He was mentioning some of the other guys who he's running against, and I think Ted Cruz
might have
been one of them. So he's like,
that'd be awesome.
He might have said Oprah before, but now that he's got to pretend he's a little farther along, so his pretending has to get next level.
He said stuff like that Carl Icahn would be a member of his cabinet, and I was like, so you're really trying to win over 40% of the on-air talent at CNBC with that. Great. I mean, do you know anyone who people actually know?
You know, he'd bring in a lot of
doddering 80-year-old capitalist weirdos. It's just kind of strange to me.
The Donald.
But this is why I can't really engage with it is because I don't think he actually wants to be president. And one of the
You're right.
It's the worst. It's for him. It is a worst case scenario.
Yeah. It would suck. It's like a hard job.
Right. But there's nothing that he stands to lose from losing a presidential election or from not, you know, anything that he's doing in this election is only going to help him and his ego. It's a win-win situation for him.
Right.
He got two magazine covers this week. I think he got Time Magazine and Entertainment Weekly. I don't want to say the wrong.
Entertainment Weekly.
Yeah, that's what he wants.
I think it's kind of funny that people, to just get back to what you were saying, that people were so upset when we moved like just like Trump statements to entertainment. Like we've been covering like his effect on the politics and politics, but we just put his statements in entertainment. And what I find so funny about this is like with a few exceptions, like most media critics and a bunch of people who work at other news organizations were like wounded by the fact we did that. They said, you can't decide how you cover him. And I was like, we actually can. It's actually our job. And if it's weird to you, I have good news. You don't work for the Huffington Post. And you'll probably never work for us. So if you're hung up about how it's going to affect your job, don't worry about it. Cover him however you like.
People just want to pick on us because we're winners.
Right. One of the things—
Just like Trump.
I'll be honest with you. One of the things I like about it is that I think of Donald Trump as a classic example of what Daniel Boorstin called a pseudo-event, which is a synthetic bit of news that ends up gaining salience and relevance because we, as people who are in the news business, need to present stories, and not just stories, but stories that kind of like achieve a certain amount of expectations. Like every day we go to work and we have to like break a big story. There has to be something novel and exciting to show people on a daily basis. And Trump comes and fits the bill for us. You know, it fits the bill for everybody. He's extremely novel and he's exciting and he's larger than life. And so we can just put him to work. And it's like a lot of people are just like, this is awesome. It's August and we can talk about this in 2016. Normally you'd be talking about what? Some bullshit. Some like, some dude joined a campaign. Some fucking strategist you never heard of. He's working with Rubio now. Some donor you never heard of thinks he might back somebody. All that invisible primary bullshit that's so hard to sell. You know, instead we got Trump telling people that Mexicans are rapists. It's amazing. You know, it's a classic pseudo event. But the move that Ryan has asked us to make, which is to like consider Trump simultaneously as an entertainment phenomenon and a political phenomenon, I think it forces us to confront the pseudo event nature of Donald Trump's candidacy on a daily basis. And it also forces us to try to think unconventionally about how to cover him. You know, you've been talking about how he's like Biff, Back to the Future.
Yes.
Right? That story doesn't come out. We don't write that story if we're not thinking unconventionally. And my only disappointment is that we should think of other ways to do stuff like this, shake stuff up, and be unconventional the way we cover politics.
Well, if the listeners have any suggestions, we've got Back to the Future, we have White Men Can't Jump, and I'm
looking
for a third movie that helps explain the Trump phenomenon.
So yeah, people, I
hit that, me on Twitter.
Yeah. I would say that, like, if you're a reader or a listener and you're worried about the decision we've made, I want to sympathize with you and understand it with you, but join us. Like, take a dip into the center of the pool with us and, like, see what we can make together. Call us up, say, you know, share your unconventional thoughts about Trump and your unconventional thoughts about politics, you know, and it'll just help us be better. You know, I think that we're like, I think it's helped us think a lot more interesting thoughts about what's going on in the world by being
maybe constantly
forced
Trump
to confront this.
Forrest Trump.
Forrest Trump. Now we're just spitballing. But this, I mean,
well, anyway.
This is how a lot of like nonsense gets made. We think of a frame and then we like start working on how to jam it in the frame. That's how a lot of comedy gets made. All right. Well, I guess we'll be back next week talking about Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Right.
Donald.
Maybe.
Make America Great Again.
Do you know that's Rick Perry's? That's Rick Perry's Super PAC's name.
What?
Yeah, that was Rick Perry's 2012 Super PAC name. Make America Great Again.
Wow, what are the odds two different people would think of that in politics?
I know. Make America what? Neat. Clean America's. Make America's bed again.
But leave the infrastructure and the education. Don't touch that.
Yeah. Let that fall into decrepitude. Let that fall apart. Okay. I've dragged this segment out way longer than it needed to be.
Let's deport ourselves.
Yes. We're going to deport. We're going to self-deport right now. Dante, what is your Twitter handle?
It is at Dante Stallworth.
Oh, that's pretty. That's
nice and easy.
That is really easy.
He has enough followers already.
Donte.
There you go.
Stall, like a stall.
Yep.
And then worth.
Worth.
Like know your value, know your worth.
There you go.
So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced and edited by Adriana Usero, with technical direction from Brad Shannon and assistance from Christine Canetta. I'm Jason Linkins. This week, we were joined by former National Football League wide receiver Dante Stallworth, as well as Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, Paige Lavender, Travis Waldron, and Allie Watkins. So That Happened is sponsored by Casper Mattresses. Go to casper.com/happened to see what Casper can do for your nights of sleep. So That Happened is available on iTunes. Check us out in the iTunes store for the Huffington Post whole family of podcasts. Subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, please send us an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. As always, thank you so much for listening. We miss you already.